This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillig, filling in for John Hockenberry. We thank you so much for listening. And our top story again today, the acrimonious state of the relationship between the United States and its ally Israel. Secretary of State John Kerry delivered an impassioned and in a lot of ways a remarkable hour-long defense of the U.S.'s decision to abstain from a U.N. Security Council vote that condemned the construction of Israeli settlements in the West Bank. Kerry worried that the goal of two states, one Jewish, one Palestinian, living side by side, is slipping away.
Friends need to tell each other the hard truths, and friendships require mutual respect. This friend, the United States of America, that has done more to support Israel than any other country, cannot be true to our own values or even the stated democratic values of Israel if we allow a viable two-state solution to be destroyed before our own eyes.
Now, the strength of the U.S.-Israel relationship below this acrimony has been on full display. Earlier this year, the United States agreed to send a record $38 billion in military aid over the next decade. But Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu did not find signs of friendship in John Kerry's words, and he gave a harsh rebuttal about 45 minutes later.
What he did was to spend most of his speech blaming Israel for the lack of peace. The Jewish people have sought their place under the sun for 3,000 years, and we're not about to be swayed by mistaken policies that have caused great, great damage.
That was Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday. Senator George Mitchell has spent a great deal of time shuttling between the Americans and Benjamin Netanyahu. He's a former Democratic senator from Maine and a majority leader, and from 2009 until 2011, U.S. Special Envoy to the Middle East. Senator, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, John Kerry's main message yesterday was that the two-state solution is in jeopardy. Do you think that that's true?
Yes, I do. I think support for it is declining among Israelis, among Palestinians, and among some in the United States. And I agree with his central premise that the two-state solution is the only viable way to bring this difficult and historic conflict to an end in a way that meets the primary objective of both sides.
Well, how important are Jewish settlements to this whole puzzle? John Kerry himself said that they were just one of many, many factors, of course, keeping Israelis and Palestinians apart, but that continuing settlement activity is this catalyst, right, that's pushing a two-state solution toward the brink. Can you contextualize that?
Yes, it is just one of many issues. Indeed, not the most difficult. Jerusalem plainly will be the most difficult issue to resolve, although they're all very hard individually and collectively. With respect to settlements, the issue is that if enough settlements are established and enough settlers live in the West Bank, then there is no place for a Palestinian state in that area. Indeed, that's the stated objective of many of those who are part of the settler movement in Israel, and many are part of the government now. They state that as their objective, as a way of preventing a Palestinian state from ever being established on the West Bank. So it's an important issue, by means not the only issue, not even in the end the most important issue, but it's one that has to be dealt with.
So we heard some of Benjamin Netanyahu's harsh words in a response, not unfamiliar words for John Kerry and Obama. I think a lot of us might have expected the prime minister to say things like that. But let's step back from this a little bit, Senator. How does this compare with past periods of tension between Israel and the U.S. government? Does this feel like a blip to you, or the kind of moment that can lead to a backlash and a pendulum swing, in this case, a reaction to the right, where the United States and its allies in the government in Israel get more hawkish, much more hawkish, in reaction to the Obama years?
The United States-Israel relationship is strong and deep, and it exists between the peoples, and not just who happens to be head of the government at this time. And it will survive this disagreement. Indeed, this is less intense and less difficult and less fraught with danger than many that have occurred in the past. When President Eisenhower was in office, Israel joined with Britain and France to invade Egypt and seize the Suez Canal. And Eisenhower demanded they withdraw, wouldn't even talk to Prime Minister Ben-Gurion. Prime Minister Ben-Gurion asked, pleaded, could he speak with him? Eisenhower refused, and Eisenhower told him, conveyed the message, he wouldn't talk to him until after they withdrew, and Eisenhower threatened to go to the UN himself and introduced a resolution that would require Israel to withdraw. So that was an extremely difficult period. When Ronald Reagan presented his peace plan in 1982, Prime Minister Begin said it was the worst time of his life as prime minister, and he strongly attacked Reagan in terms far more harsh than what Netanyahu has used. Netanyahu didn't get along with President Clinton. So there's nothing new in all of this. These are two vibrant democracies. And while we're close friends, is it inevitable that there are differences in policy? I think the important thing is that we not lose sight of what the objective is here. That is to bring Israelis and Palestinians together in direct negotiations that will enable each to achieve its primary objective in the manner that I've described previously as set out by President George W. Bush.
You said that you think President Obama would have been wiser to prevent this recent resolution of Friday or veto it altogether, given the timing. One interpretation here is that the abstention allowed this moment for a warning flag that John Kerry could deliver, that Trump and Netanyahu may be entering an impossibly hawkish and conservative phase in the relationship and in the relationship with the Palestinians, at least in their view.
Well, unfortunately, I think the atmosphere created by the resolution made it much more difficult for Kerry's message to get through. And my concern was that since the principal objective of American policy is to bring the two sides together to negotiate these issues, they're now actually further apart. And I think both are taking courses that are destructive to their own interests. The Palestinians, as many of their officials have said in the last few days, feel emboldened by this and going to pursue further their policy of trying to achieve nationhood through international institutions. I don't think it can happen that way because that might lead to a nominal state, but a real state on the ground requires the participation and consent of Israel. Israel is the dominant power there. It occupies the territory. It controls the territory. So it doesn't make any difference how many resolutions you pass in distant capitals. They're not going to bring about a state on the ground for the Palestinians who live there. On the other hand, the Prime Minister of Israel, a country already isolated in the Muslim world, which comprises now one-fifth of the world's population, in a few decades will be a third of the population, is, in my judgment, increasing the isolation by carrying on against the countries who voted for this resolution. Britain, France, Spain, New Zealand, all natural allies of Israel. It is significant, I believe, that to the best of my knowledge, not one country in the world out of nearly 200 countries has come out in public support of Israel's position on this settlements resolution. And contrary to some of the criticism that has been made by President Obama's opponents in the United States and in Israel, there's nothing new in this resolution. In the Carter administration, in the Reagan administration, in the George H.W. Bush administration, there were resolutions passed which the United States either let pass or actually supported that are identical in language and import and impact to what is being said today. The argument that I've heard many commentators make, oh, this is something new, this is dramatic. It isn't. People should go back and read the other resolutions. Some of them use the exact words. So to make it out to be this dramatic change, I think, is a misimpression. Prime Minister Netanyahu is in a tough spot. Everybody involved is in a tough spot. But he's caught between an international community that is overwhelmingly opposed to continued settlement expansion in the West Bank, on the one hand, and his government is now dependent upon settler support and indeed includes people who are much more aggressive in terms of settlement than he is. And so he's like most political leaders. He's trying to preserve his position, so he's trying to make it seem as though if you're against settlements, you're against Israel. Well, as his opposition within Israel has pointed out, they don't think that's the case, that you can be against further settlement expansion and still be very much pro-Israel.
And what is the likely reaction on the part of Fatah, the Palestinian Authority, the Palestinian governments in the West Bank, Senator? If settlements continue or accelerate, and there is a strong signal that commitment to a two-state solution has waned. What, in your view, happens if enough Palestinians start to feel like political solutions don't hold any future for them?
Well, I fear that the Palestinian Authority will be unsustainable. The Palestinians are divided, just as the Israelis, on the question of a two-state solution. Fatah, the Palestinian Authority, has stated that it accepts Israel's existence. It opposes violence against Israelis. It agrees to abide by all prior agreements. Those positions are not the position of Hamas, the opposition among the Palestinians, which controls Gaza. But unfortunately for President Abbas and the Palestinian Authority, they've been saying this for 25 years and they haven't made much progress. Now, the two sides will argue over who is responsible for that lack of progress, each blaming the other. When I talked to Prime Minister Netanyahu, I urged him, now in a position of great strength militarily, economically, with the full backing of the United States, to reach out and make an agreement. And, of course, he was concerned about the possibility that a Palestinian state would fail. And it would be dangerous because of the proximity of the West Bank to Israel, and Hamas would take over. That's a risk. It's a valid concern. But my argument to him was the risk of the Palestinian Authority failing is greater in the absence of an agreement than it is if there were an agreement to which Israel would be a party and a participant and have some strong assurances with U.S. and international support. And if the Palestinian Authority collapses and Hamas takes over, then that is a nightmare for Israel, which would be required to engage in another full-scale occupation, be responsible for the population. More than half the Palestinian population needs food assistance and other forms of assistance. That's all now paid for by the UN, the United States, the European Union, and others. So I think that both sides ultimately will come to the realization that, difficult as getting an agreement is, and it will be extremely difficult and even more difficult to implement, the alternatives are worse for both sides. So they're better off getting together and trying to deal with these issues. And as the Palestinians, I also told President Abbas, look, the United States opposes settlements. Nine American presidents, five Republicans and four Democrats, over the 50 years of the life of the settlement enterprise, have opposed settlements. But the Israelis keep building them. So the best thing to do is to sit down with them, reach an agreement, agree on a border, and then you can build what you want on the Palestinian side, and the Israelis can build what they want on the Israeli side.
But, Senator, we have a new American president, before we let you go, who has sent strong signals that he is not anti-settlement and that his ambassador is not anti-settlement. And I wonder what your greatest realistic, unblinkered hope is for the Trump administration in this regard.
Well, I don't think that the views taken by Mr. Friedman as a private citizen will necessarily be those of the Trump administration. Obviously, as you said, Trump has sent signals of support for Israel, but he has not yet explicitly rejected the American policy of opposition to further settlement expansion. He has not sent a signal of supporting some of Mr. Friedman's other statements, reportedly supporting the possibility of Israeli annexation of the entire West Bank, and some of the other more controversial positions taken by various groups in Israel and in the United States. So I think there's a wait and see period. And I think once Mr. Trump gets into more detail on the complexity of the region, and I have to make an important point here. It should not be the case that people consider the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in isolation from the rest of the region. It exists within a region that is now extremely volatile, going through a great deal of turbulence and violence. It impacts on those external events, and those events in turn impact on the Israeli-Palestinian relationship. And a broader view is essential, and I hope Mr. Trump will take the time and get the advice to consider it within that context and consider how critically valuable it will be if Israelis and Palestinians can reach an agreement between themselves, as Israel has done with Egypt and has done with Jordan, both of which are now pillars of stability in the region and for Israel, that it will be very helpful if they can do that, because that would free up the Gulf Arab states and others in the region to normalize relations with Israel and enable them to act on their common interest of concern and opposition to Iran's drive to establish hegemony in that entire region.
Senator George Mitchell is the former U.S. Special Envoy for the Middle East between 2009 and 2011. Senator, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
American Jews are one of the groups closely watching this week as the Obama administration delivered some parting shots and final pleas on Israel and its relationship to the Palestinians. Now, according to polls, a majority of American Jews support President Obama and favor the two-state framework for peace. But there are many, many critics, and a sizable portion of American Jews have been eager for a new, tougher approach promised by President-elect Donald Trump and a new chapter in an allied relationship that was increasingly tense during Obama's years. One of those people is Lori Lowenthal Marcus. She's a lawyer and co-chair of the group Jews Choose Trump, which, as the name suggests, is an organization of American Jews who favored Donald Trump's candidacy. And she joins me now from Jerusalem, where she's on holiday. Lori, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well. Thanks for joining us, Lori. You're in Jerusalem now, as I mentioned. How did people there who you talked to react to Secretary of State John Kerry's speech and the events at the UN over the weekend?
The response was uniformly negative. People who would otherwise like what Secretary of State Kerry had to say felt as if, why are you coming out now 3 weeks before the end of your term? If you really wanted to do something, you should have done it way before. And many other people feel as if it's merely a nasty effort to delegitimize Israel as this administration sails out into the sunset.
There was a lot packed in to John Kerry's critique, you know, all of the usual sort of statements about strong support for Israel, unwavering backing, both militarily and diplomatically, Israel's right to exist, and all the rest of it. I mean, I think we're familiar with that. But a real critique of settlements and how they're endangering a two-state solution for peace with the Palestinians. Did that part of John Kerry's message resonate with anybody that you know? Is there something in there that people thought maybe there is a danger here, or did they just see it as the parting shot you're describing?
Well, the problem is that everybody in Israel, just about everybody, feels as though, how can you possibly equate the building of homes for peaceful citizens with terrorism? And sadly, that's exactly what he's done. So Jews building homes for Jews is what attracted all of the attention and is, despite his saying otherwise, all of the blame for any lack of peace, whereas terrorism, violence, refusal to recognize the Jewish state as having a right to exist, those are simply, if at all, mentioned and brushed aside.
So we're just a little more than 20 days from a Donald Trump presidency. You supported him. Was that strong support? Was it reluctant? What drew you to him?
So initially, he was not my choice at all. I am a registered Democrat. I did not support Hillary Clinton. And frankly, I didn't support President Obama either time. What drew me eventually to Donald Trump when he became the nominee, I began to pay close attention to what he had been saying about security of the United States and of Israel, his distaste and willingness to alter the so-called Iran deal was very important for me, very important. I thought that there are issues. He's sometimes often unpredictable. However, he had made many right statements on the issues that I find to be most important, which is national security and foreign policy.
I want to play you, Lori Lowenthal Marcus, a statement, part of Donald Trump's speech that he made during the campaign in October in Florida. Listen.
We've seen this firsthand in the WikiLeaks documents in which Hillary Clinton meets in secret with international banks to plot the destruction of U.S. sovereignty in order to enrich these global financial powers, her special interest friends and her donors.
Lori, I know you were listening to this speech when Donald Trump made it, and those statements were widely viewed as using very old anti-Semitic tropes, some of them lifted out of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, an old and well-worn anti-Semitic screed from turn-of-the-century Europe. What was your reaction when you heard that speech, and how have you digested it since?
Look, if I was hearing that speech completely out of context, my ears might have gone up. But I know, certainly by October, that Donald Trump has surrounded himself with people who are fervent supporters of Israel, who are religious observant Jews. I know that he is not an anti-Semite. It's a losing argument to try and find anti-Semitism in Donald Trump's actions or his positions is just a non-starter.
Lori Lowenthal Marcus, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Lori Lowenthal Marcus is a lawyer. She's co-chair of Jews Choose Trump. President Obama designated two new national monuments yesterday, protecting 1.65 million acres of land. Bears Ears Butte is in Utah and Gold Butte is in southern Nevada. And Obama made the move using the 1906 Antiquities Act. President Obama is trying to preserve his green legacy from an incoming Trump administration that has promised to undo environmental regulations. Conservation groups and Native American tribes applauded Obama's move, but some elected officials in both states were vehemently opposed to both of the monuments. Kristen Brangle is the Vice President for Government Affairs at the National Parks Conservation Association, and she joins me now. Kristen, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Well, both Bears Ears Buttes and Gold Butte have been the subject of long-running disputes in Nevada and Utah over land use. Describe these two places and sort of what the controversies have been like.
They're both exceptional places. They're beautiful. They are the typical Western red rock lands that you see in movies and in pictures, and they're extremely threatened by mining and looting and other activities that happen out there. So essentially, we have millions of acres like this. These are unique. These are completely surrounded by national parks, Canyonlands National Park, Arches National Park, and in Nevada, Lake Mead and the Grand Canyon. And they're controversial simply because, you know, folks want to continue to graze and do certain activities, which they'll be able to continue under this monument proclamation that they're both existing under. And so it's kind of disappointing when folks are negative about them, because they're incredible areas and the public will really enjoy them even more now.
So when a national monument like this is designated, that means things like mining can't continue, but surface activities, grazing, things that are renewable can continue?
Correct. And under the proclamation that President Obama signed for both monuments, grazing can continue. And that's one of the major activities out there. There really isn't as much oil and gas. And even the oil and gas leases that are there are going to be grandfathered in. So there's no real threat to those activities.
So what do you see President Obama doing here when you sort of step back from these two territories that have been designated monuments? Is this a defense of an environmental legacy that has been disappointing to some? What do you think he's doing?
President Obama, in his 8 years in office, has protected some of the greatest places in the country that were unprotected before he came into office. So he's kind of doing what others haven't done in the past and protecting more wonderful places, rock art, artifacts, than any other president has been able to designate before him.
Well, if President Obama can designate these monuments under the Antiquities Act, could possibly President Trump turn around and undesignate them?
No, he can't. The Antiquities Act is written in a way to actively protect areas, but not to undo protection for areas. So he has absolutely no authority to undo a monument. Congress could, but not another president. And it's never been done before.
So now that Harry Reid, who was a huge advocate of Gold Butte in Nevada, I mean, I can tell you that he talked about it all the time. Harry Reid won't be in the Senate after January 2nd. A Republican Congress could turn around if they mustered the votes and undo these monument designations.
Undoing any type of protection like a national monument or a national park is something that no Congress wants to be known for doing. These are special places. People cherish these places. They love them. Congress would get an incredibly even worse reputation than they already have if they started to dismantle places of high public value that people love and appreciate, like national monuments and national parks.
Utah and Nevada each have a new national monument designated by President Obama on his way out of the White House, Bears Ears Buttes and Gold Butte. Kristen Brengel, Vice President of Governmental Affairs at National Parks Conservation Association. Thank you.
Thank you.
We go to Venezuela now, where a failed economy and political upheaval are conspiring to cause massive food shortages. And now an investigation by the Associated Press shows that the Venezuelan military is making money off of people's starvation. The country is nearly entirely dependent on imports for its food supply. And in an effort to address crippling shortages, President Nicolas Maduro put the military in control of the food system back in July. But the AP found that that military has been profiting off of this control, setting the prices for food and taking kickbacks at every step of the way. Hannah Dreyer is the Venezuela correspondent for the AP, and she's one of the people who conducted this investigation. She joins me now from Caracas. Hannah, welcome to The Takeaway.
Good to be with you, Todd.
So you've done a deep investigation here, interviews, documents, and observations. Explain how this food racket that the military is conducting in Venezuela, how it works.
So the most important thing to know is that there's severe hunger in Venezuela right now. People are waiting in food lines, but we also have children who are dying of malnutrition, people who are going through the trash every day looking for any scrap of food. And amid all of this, the government has put the military in control of all aspects of importing food, distributing food, food production. It all goes through the military. And what we found is that the military has turned it into a racket. So they're making money on everything from the contracts to when the food gets sold at the markets. For one example, we talked to a businessman who got a contract to import corn from the current food minister. And the corn was billed at double the going rate. So Venezuela gave him a contract to import $25 million worth of corn for $50 million. The businessman said that he was able to get that sweet contract because he gave millions in kickbacks to the food minister.
So what do ordinary people who need food, what do they do when they discover that, no, food is available, there's ample food, it's just only available if the military gets your money and gets their cut?
One thing that a lot of people said to me was they feel like the military is getting fat while their children get skinny. I talked to some people who, right at the port where all the food comes in, spend their days outside picking up the grains of rice and corn that fall out of the trucks. So they're just living right at the margin of starvation. And meanwhile, there are these military guys who are walking all around them who have nice shirts on and nice cars. So nobody is missing what's happening, but there's a sense that the authorities don't care.
So this horrible food situation, these shortages, Hannah, really fundamentally are about the collapse of the price of oil.
Right. I mean, there were underlying economic problems before the price of oil dropped. Domestic production of food had been drying up for years after the government nationalized farms and factories. But it kind of didn't matter because there was so much oil money and the price of oil was so high. But then 2 years ago, when the price of oil dropped, all the problems in the economy were revealed.
And Nicolas Maduro, the president, meanwhile, it sounds like faces this disconnect, right? I mean, people know when they're hungry. They know when their kids don't have enough food, even if there's politics around, you know, the Congress versus Maduro. I wouldn't think that would make much difference to people.
Right. People are furious about this. But one clever thing that Maduro has done is he's really managed to stifle discontent within the ranks of the military. Venezuela has a long history of the military participating in coups. And that's always the question here. Is the military going to rise up against Maduro, who's very unpopular? And by doing this, by putting the military in charge of food and allowing them to run these corruption scams, a lot of people think Maduro has successfully pacified the military.
Are there any serious investigations into this corruption in all of its levels? I mean, in a way that could actually lead to accountability?
Well, so the best chance is probably the Congress, which is controlled right now by the opposition. The Socialist Administration controls all the other branches of government. And Congress, going off of the overpayments that were shown in the Food Ministry's annual report, has already censured the food minister for corruption. President Maduro responded with the Congress is trying to attack the Socialist Party. I'm ignoring this. We do know that prosecutors in the U.S. are now investigating officials because some of these bribes, we think, went through the U.S. financial system. But for now, there aren't strong independent institutions that can really take on the issue of corruption until the government itself decides it wants to do that.
Hannah Dreyer, Venezuela correspondent for the AP. Thanks, Hannah.
Great to be with you.
In the Philippines, President Rodrigo Duterte has become infamous for his violent crackdown on drug users, drug dealers, and even former addicts. More than 2,000 people reportedly have been killed by police, and at least 1,000 more by suspected vigilantes. Duterte has faced international criticism, but at home in the Philippines, his approval ratings remain high. Aurora Almendral is a reporter and radio producer based in Manila. She spent the night on patrol last month with police in Manila as they enforced Duterte's anti-drug campaign with door-to-door stops in search of suspects. And she chronicled this ride-along for our partner, The New York Times, and she told me the lines are blurred when it comes to the role of the police and the role of vigilantes in Duterte's violent street war.
Before you meet them, it seems like they're making quite a large effort to do everything by the book, but by the time you're out on the street, rubber hits the road, and it seems like everything is falling apart. I mean, I came away from there feeling as though the operation was a little bit bungled. I had joined the police at about 6 at night, and it happened that one of the substations that was patrolling one of the worst slums in Manila was doing an operation where they're going door-to-door to the surrendered drug users to see how they were doing, and they were eager to show me that not everyone was dying in the drug campaign and that they were trying to help. But it turned out there's so much fear on the street that a lot of the people that we were supposed to see had run off to different provinces or wanted to escape and not be there when the police came, because while the police wanted to show that they were helping the community, it seemed like most of the people they were trying to help were afraid of them.
So we have this situation where the president, Rodrigo Duterte, has basically declared war, not only on drugs, but also on users and dealers. Do the people that you encountered believe that the police are the instruments of that kind of killing, or do they fear other vigilante squads or other neighbors that they might have?
I think on the ground in the slums that have been targeted by this campaign against drugs that Duterte is doing, most people don't believe that they're vigilante killers. They don't differentiate between the police by-bust operations and these sort of drive-by killings by unknown assailants. To them, all the killings they feel are being done by the police.
Well, that sounds like a population, quite apart from any concern about drugs, that's terrorized.
Yeah, I mean, they're absolutely terrorized. There are stories on the street, even beyond the ones that I'd written about in the article, where teenage boys are just playing dice outside at night, and then motorcycle will come up to them, chase one of them down to the end of the alley while the rest scatter and shoot the kid. There was one kid that was shot 12 times. That creates a lot of terror among people.
And while you were along with the police or in your reporting afterward, did you witness any interaction between police and some of the vigilantes who might be up to this kind of violence?
Not in my reporting, but there's one case where a vigilante on motorcycles killed a woman. Those two happened to be caught and unmasked by the police, and they turned out to be high-ranking police officers.
So I understand the party line from the police and their leadership and the politicians that they don't condone this type of vigilante killing. But what about individual cops who you might have talked to sort of offline or on the side? How do they feel about this policy from their president and what's going on in the streets?
Some of the police officers, they don't agree with the vigilante killings. They feel bad that that the community that they're policing trusts them even less because they think that they're vigilante killers. So it's something that challenges their ability to police the community. Other police officers say that it helps create the sense of fear that's part of how they are enforcing order right now, you know, and keeping people in line.
Did you encounter any residents who thought, hey, if this is what it takes to get rid of the drug dealers and the drugs, maybe it's worth it?
There's a lot of ambivalence in Filipinos in general about how to take this. And that shows up both in the people I talk to in the slums and in the polls that are taken quarterly in the Philippines. Most Filipinos are against drugs, of course, and they're also against crime. And they have seen a drop in crime since Duterte became president. So in a lot of ways, he still continues to get a lot of support from Filipinos. Nobody wants to see the killings, but they haven't gotten to the point to turn against Duterte.
You spoke to one police captain who you described as a strong supporter of Duterte and his policies. What did he tell you?
He told me that this was the golden age of Philippine policing, that for the first time, the Philippine government is backing the police and it's enabling them to do their jobs properly. And he was very vocal in his support of the president. He thinks that Duterte has finally given the police the power that they're due, although organizations that are opposed to their methods, like the Philippine government-funded Commission on Human Rights, believe that Duterte's methods are just creating increased impunity in the police to do whatever they want.
So, Aurora Almendral, having seen what you saw on your ride-along, talking to that police captain, to terrorized residents, others who might not be ready to turn against the government, where does this go?
I mean, that's really the question, right? How is this going to end? And is it even going to achieve what it's trying to achieve? And I think in other countries that have instituted similar, though not as brutal, methods like Thailand, the effects on the drug use rate and the crime rate has been short-lived. So at the moment, it seems that the fear and terrorizing of these neighborhoods is causing a drop in crime and drug use rates. But a lot of people are asking when the killings will end. And many of the people that I spoke to believe that they're not going to end until Duterte is no longer president.
Aurora Almendral has been spending time riding along with police in Manila in the midst of a policy from President Rodrigo Duterte that has many residents terrorized, vigilantes armed, killing drug dealers and drug users. Aurora Almendral, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
You know, there are a lot of people who are ready to just get out of 2016 already. A pretty awful year for a lot of folks in a lot of ways. And forget about electoral politics. People from Prince to Debbie Reynolds have passed away. And so did a sports world legend, the greatest, Muhammad Ali. But hey, 2016 wasn't all bad. Not when you hear this.
And the Chicago Cubs win the World Series.
Simone Biles, 15-9.
The national championship goes to Connecticut for the fourth year in a row.
The Cavaliers are NBA champions.
Ledecky, gold medal. Ledecky, world record.
Dave Zirin is here. He's sports editor for The Nation magazine, and he says 2016 was a year of spectacular performances on the field and the court, but also one where athletes use their status and their fame to dive into important social and political issues. He starts us off with a couple of Midwestern cities that broke curses this year.
In Cleveland, you're talking about the Cavaliers winning the city's first title since 1964 in any sport whatsoever. And this was a city that was actually nicknamed in the 1950s the City of Champions. And the fact that there have been no titles since 1964 for many people in Cleveland, it mirrored the fall of the city itself from being an industrial center to being part of the so-called Rust Belt. So that's very intense.
Yeah.
And so to have the Cavs break that, it has all sorts of symbolism attached to it.
But the Cubs curse, I mean, this was the most famous curse in sports, the longest one, and really the one that even non-baseball fans kind of knew about.
Oh, and the ratings reflected that in a major way. I mean, the ratings for the World Series were the highest baseball had seen since the early 1990 World Series, which is amazing. It just shows you the degree to which people reattached themselves to the sport who had fallen away. And also the parallels as well are two teams that were down 3-1. So two teams where, you know, better luck next year looked like not just prophecy, but probability.
So we'll stay on the field or in the pool. I mean, the Rio Olympics in 2016 had some stellar athletic performances from Simone Biles, Katie Ledecky, Simone Manuel, of course, Michael Phelps, just, you know, unbelievable records. And people could follow all these triumphs and accomplishments. And then this quintessentially American media sideshow of Ryan Lochte and this Access Hollywood nonsense antics that people went crazy for. And this was just the most, you know, American thing that you could do, you know?
I got to tell you, I was in Rio for the entire Ryan Lochte drama. And it was remarkable on a very grassroots, ground floor level to see how the emotions changed. And then to have Ryan Lochte, who I think unarguably is one of the 10 most famous Olympians on earth, to have him say that he was held up at gunpoint by a police officer and robbed, people felt this tremendous amount of shame. I mean, people were like, oh my God, we came so close to pulling this off without some international embarrassment. And then this happens. But the part about it that's the most egregious is just how upset it made people in Brazil, to the point of which there was this big board at the Rio International Airport where people were writing like goodbye messages in dozens of different languages to the people of Rio. And it was very beautiful. And I went back to the airport a couple times just to look at how that board was progressing over the days. And after the Lochte thing, I mean, dozens and dozens of messages of people saying, we're sorry for Ryan Lochte. Please don't judge all Americans by Ryan Lochte. And so the shame wasn't just Rio shame moving to anger. It was U.S. sort of smugness, I would argue, then moving to shame and embarrassment.
And all of us in the media can take some responsibility for that, but there's just no getting around that it was a low point for an otherwise fantastic Olympics. At the same time, Ethiopian marathoner Faisal Lelessa made a huge international statement when he crossed the finish line of silver medal in the marathon that wasn't consumed very widely in this country.
No, that's exactly right. Faisal Lelessa, who I interviewed in person, is from the Oromo people in Ethiopia. And currently, there is just mammoth oppression taking place of the Oromo as there's an effort to expand the capital city of Addis Ababa. And people are being displaced by the hundreds. People are being killed. People are disappearing. And the international symbol of resistance is holding your arms up and crossing your arms. I mean, doing that in front of the wrong military official at the wrong time can be a death sentence in Ethiopia. And so Lelessa doing that, I mean, it made him a hero. People wrote folk songs about him. One of the things that he showed, which is, I think, a very useful lesson going forward, is that the brighter the light you shine on issues such as this, the greater chance of, frankly, survival. Because the Ethiopian government has had to say explicitly that his family is not in danger, that he can come home. And, you know, that would certainly, you know, not be the case if he had just, frankly, even come home without making that symbol, because he felt in danger before he made that sign. But the fact that he was so public with it makes it actually much harder to go after him.
I want to talk about Colin Kaepernick, of course, one of the major sports stories and political stories of the year. But I want to talk about him in the context of Muhammad Ali, who died this year. And I want to talk about these two guys together. Colin Kaepernick, of course, the quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers, famously takes a knee during the playing of the national anthem to protest the treatment of people of color at the hands of police, earned a lot of enemies and a lot of supporters. Dave Zirin, what's been shocking to me was how many people angry at Colin Kaepernick, and that's fine to be angry at him, you don't have to like his protest, took this tone, like he's fortunate, you know, he should therefore shut up and play, and that he doesn't have any moral standing because he's privileged, and almost no appreciation from these same quarters that Muhammad Ali was similarly situated back in the 60s, not identical, but was maligned, was hated, was told to shut up, and this is a guy who wound up with presidents at his funeral. Because people in retrospect realized that he was right to protest and that he used his privilege and gave it all up for something bigger than himself.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing about Colin Kaepernick that I think has made his protest so electric as well. It's saying, no, there's something fundamentally wrong systemically. Colin Kaepernick's case, it was how we do policing in this country. Muhammad Ali, it was U.S. foreign policy and its connection to racism at home. They said, no, that there's a real division here and we should acknowledge it and we're taking a side. Kaepernick is showing that dissent can be visible and attractive, the same way Muhammad Ali showed that dissent can be visible and attractive, which is certainly, I don't think, the way dissent is often portrayed in our society or in our culture. And that makes it very powerful. And Colin Kaepernick also very consciously sees himself as part of a history that's connected to Muhammad Ali. He's been wearing Muhammad Ali shirts to games, speaking about he doesn't think that Muhammad Ali should have had to have died in vain. And I really do think there's a connection between all these athletes who are trying to stand up and speak out and the fact that Ali's funeral happened this year and forced so many people to reckon with the actuality of who Ali was, not just the kind of silent figure who he was for so many decades because of Parkinson's.
Dave Zirin is sports editor for The Nation magazine, reflecting with us on some of the big sports moments of 2016.
My name is Lois. I'm calling from Harlem. My favorite sports moment of 2016 was the selection of the Olympic women's gymnastics team. I looked at the screen with amazement to see that 3 out of the 5 were young women of color and included a Latina. I have to admit, I cried.
This is Emma from Normal, Illinois. My favorite sports moment of 2016 was the Cubs winning the World Series. Did anything else in 2016 even matter?
Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can always head to the Takeaways Facebook page. Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. The legendary jam band Phish is playing a four-night run at Madison Square Garden in New York this week. They perennially sell it out, and that's pretty much the case wherever Phish goes these days, despite the fact that the band doesn't have any major radio hits. So what is it about jam music that works so well? That's Phish playing their improvisational mainstay Tweezer. All the familiar elements are there. But what if you took that song and boiled it down to just one instrument? That is Holly Bowling, who has immersed herself in the music of Phish for her entire life. She's a classically trained pianist who specializes in reimagining Phish and the Grateful Dead in her unique way. And she's now released albums of covers of both bands. Her latest is called Better Left Unsung, and it tackles the music of the Grateful Dead. Holly's listed in Rolling Stone as a new artist that you need to know. She's on tour right now with dates across the country. And she joined me in the studio from behind a piano to talk about what makes her music work.
The first piece of Phish's music that I interpreted was a version of their song Tweezer from Tahoe a few years ago. And it was a 37-minute piece of improvisation that I wrote out note for note and arranged for piano and tried to take what those four guys were doing and turn it into something that I could play on this instrument with two hands. And I still do some stuff like that. I call those jam transcriptions. So I'm trying to reimagine a specific live performance. And then there's other stuff I do where it's much more open-ended and freeform, and the improvisation is very much my own. Rather than scripting their improvisation and recreating it, oftentimes I'm just trying to find a space for an open canvas where I can do this in my own voice and in my own interpretation. So,
but when you do the scripted ones, I imagine the details are important. I mean, I know a lot of Phish fans. They know the details. They know where a show goes. They recognize the theme or the conceit of a performance. And they really rely, in a way, on getting it right.
Absolutely. And I do get very detail-oriented with that kind of thing. And for me, the contrast between the super detail-oriented stuff that I want to recreate the same exact way every time, even down to how loud I play a certain note or where I put a crescendo, versus the other parts of my shows where I have a complete open-ended freedom for 20 minutes or more, where I have no idea what I'm going to do and no idea where the music's going to take me. Having that dichotomy is very important to me.
All right, so speaking of old school, let's talk Dead for a minute here. Can I ask you to play something just like really popular? Would that be all right? Can you try Friend of the Devil?
Sure, yeah. I've never really done a solo version before, but we can give
it a go. Give it a shot. Pretty good for a dry run if you've never played that solo before.
It just opens a doorway that makes me realize, man, I'd love to dive into that one and really work on arranging it.
And it surprises me. I mean, I don't know if that was ever a top 40 hit, but it's one of their most popular songs ever. I mean, real radio play for a band that didn't really rely on it too heavily, that it's one you don't play regularly. You prefer the more obscure or more artistic songs?
I wouldn't say more obscure necessarily. I mean, part of this for me is I'm not even really super aware of what their big radio hits were. You know, I was born in 84. I never actually got to see the Dead perform with Jerry. And so I came into this music in a very sort of indirect way. I grew up hearing it as a kid. My parents were into it. And so I've been familiar with this music my whole life, but I never, you know, it was never like I heard it on the radio one day and went, oh, wow, this is the band for me, you know, and came in through their their whatever their top hits were.
Is there a difference for you in interpreting Phish and the Grateful Dead? People lump these two jam bands in together. That's probably unfair in some ways. Is there a difference for you when you perform them?
I think that they're incredibly different musically, and I see why they get lumped together. They both have a focus on improvisation and risk-taking. But one of the things I like about getting to play with both catalogs in the same show is that they cover such different ground emotionally and the character of the music and the kind of energy that it brings. And so, you know, for example, figuring out how to move between those two dynamics, you know, going from something like Phish's song It's Ice, which is very dissonant and filled with tension, into something like The Dead's Row Jimmy, that's this beautiful, sad, you know, they're just so different. So figuring out how to take the journey between one and the other and cover the ground that sets you down from one to the other gently and appropriately is it's an interesting challenge. And it really opens up the spectrum that you can play with in a show by having that repertoire.
Well, would you try that for me? Would you try Row Jimmy for me?
Sure, yeah.
That's great. So Holly, what got you into this? I mean, there's a really dedicated fan base, obviously, for both of these bands. So a ready-made audience, I guess. Was it as practical as that? You know, if I play Phish and the Dead and I'm good at it, people will want to hear it because these people love this music. They love the improvisation and there's tons of shows and I can ride that wake. Or was there more to it than that?
You know, it really wasn't a practical approach like that. And it wasn't like I woke up one morning and had this idea and said, oh, you know what would really market well is this. It was very much the opposite. I'm a huge Phish fan and a huge fan of the Dead, and just I have a love for this music. And after the show that Phish played in Lake Tahoe a few years ago, where they did that crazy 37-minute version of their song Tweezer, I went home and started working on transcribing it and arranging it for piano, just as sort of a personal project, kind of a hobby, something to work on. And I worked on it for about a year, and when I was finished, I posted a video of it online just for kicks, because I had, you know, spent a year on this huge project and just figured may as well share it. And that turned into a much larger response and audience than I had ever anticipated, and it opened the door for me to work on more of these arrangements and take them out on the road and record an album and do all these things related to it. But the whole thing was born out of something that I was just doing because I loved it, you know? I wish I could say I was smart enough to have had this strategy going in and thought, oh, this will really sell, but it,
right,
but it wasn't that at all.
But it works anyway. I think one of the great things about this, though, is that you found this music that you love and that you can arrange. On the one hand, somebody might say, oh, Holly Bowling, cover musician, but you're not that, because the basis of all this music is creativity and improvisation. You're not playing 3.5-minute radio covers in a bar. I mean, you're playing music that at its very core is about experimentation and improvisation.
Oh, it's a bunch of covers. Who cares about that, right? The beauty is in the interpretation. And even if the notes are the same every time, each person brings something different to the table. And there's a beautiful art form in that. Secondly, I work on these arrangements and really try to put my own spin on them. And there's a lot of creative decisions that go into figuring out which parts to bring in, when to take them out, what to put in the foreground, what to really bring to light the most, what to leave in the background, and how to shape the trajectory and storyline of a song. It's its own thing.
Well, people who catch Phish on the road can often see you performing near them. Phish is in New York this week at Madison Square Garden, right? You're playing a few shows in the city.
Yep, I'll be at the Cutting Room on December 30th and 31st.
And people can see and hear all of the improvisation in your performances at the Cutting Room. Holly Bowling, thanks for coming in. It's great.
Thanks for having me.
Holly Bowling, pianist, performer, Phish, and Dead enthusiast here on The Takeaway. Holly Bowling's new album is Better Left Unsung. It's available at hollybowling.com or wherever you get your music. If you want to listen to a full version of The Grateful Dead's Cassidy, played by Holly, live in our studio, head to thetakeaway.org. And that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.